Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and I'm looking at the levels here, Martin. I'm coming in very high, mate. And can you at least say you're here, because I want to see how bad this looks?
Yeah, I'm here. Oh yeah, no, it looks about the same, Tony. That's not too bad.
Listen, folks. One bit of housekeeping before we come on. We're out and buying it. By the time you get this, we probably have bought a new laptop to run the process. We would appreciate if you could put your hands in your pockets and see us clear of trying to get the money back on that, because
honest God, Tony's laptop just melted. I mean, it melted. It disappeared into this little pile of plastic and buttons. It melted. We're doing too much memory wasted on it. So we have to get ourselves something else, and we're going to the second hand shops. But please chip in a few bob there. Give us a hand there.
Look, we do appreciate the people who have signed on Patreon. It's made a difference. But yeah, no, the laptop gave up the ghost. More importantly, we're delighted to be joined in the Tortoise Shack by, and we had this conversation. How do you introduce the man? So there's no better way to introduce than the way he introduces himself. News reporter and formerly a productive member of society, Gerard Cunningham. Gerard, thanks for coming into the Tortoise Shack.
You're welcome.
We've had chats over the years online on Twitter, and I've always made the point that you've had. You know, there was a couple of people. There was maybe Fintan O'Toolbox, who has the most acerbic no comment phrase on Twitter, and you just had the one that would always deaden anything in terms of, you had a great knack for taking the emotion out of discourse and actually seeing truth to the facts, and that wit on social media comes across very powerfully as someone who actually can look at it with a dry eye. And I have to be honest with you, you're actually younger than I thought you'd be.
How old did you think I was?
Well,
how old do you think I am?
Tony had said to me somewhere in his 90s, but I didn't believe that for a second.
I would put you younger than Martin at this stage, to be honest with you. But no, I mean that genuinely, because there was always this. I hate to be so about it, but it's like having your cranky dad who's going to put you down in your box. And I said, no, you're too young to be my dad now, you know. And that's the reality. But do you mind me asking? I know, I see a lot of work you do around the NUJ and with people like that. And we have had a list of journalists through our doors and across the spectrum, but mainly the youngster. But what I want to talk about is the two styles that we see. We see the guy who does the shoe leather journalist, and then we see the Ken Fox school of things who do the FOI school of things. The mechanics of journalism and what you do, what would a typical sort of investigation look like to you?
Not an investigative journalist is probably the first thing I should say.
A news reporter, I should say.
I'm basically a court reporter.
Yeah.
Except I'm hardly ever in courts, because as a freelance, you're often told that you should specialise and find a speciality that no one else has, and that makes you sellable. And I over-specialised, and my specialty became guard the tribunals.
Yeah.
I'm not an investigative reporter. I go into basically a big room where there's a judge and a bunch of lawyers asking people questions, and I write down what they say. And that's basically my job, or most of my job. I've been a journalist since 2002. I spent 6 years on the Morris Tribunal, 2 years on the Smithick Tribunal, and a year and a half or thereabouts on the Charlton Tribunal. So that's what, 10 years, 2/3 of the time I've spent sitting in rooms listening to lawyers.
But I see. This is the thing. But when you put a report out, which you did in quite great volume, when you're putting those things out, people are going to interpret them in they're going to read into it. You know, our own confirmation biases, as you know, whereby we're reading some of these reports, and some of us are. So are you cognizant of that, or are you just saying, look, I reported as it was said?
It's become much clearer in the last one. Because I was able to follow a lot of the commentary online on Twitter in real time about what was going on with Maurice McCabe at the Charlton Tribunal, and some of the conspiracy theories there were very over the top. There was a bit of it with with the Smithwick Tribunal, but the horrible blunt truth is that the Smithwick Tribunal was about the murder of two RUC men 30 years ago, and nobody in the South cared. And that was clear from the fact that, apart from the Irish Times, which felt it had to cover it as the newspaper of record, and RTE, it was barely covered here until the report came out. But the daily sittings, most days, you could pick up the Irish Independent or the Examiner and so on, and there wouldn't be a mention of the fact that that tribunal was happening.
And we do, there is a cliche or that goes that in the Republic of Ireland, they look at the North as the attic. You forget it's there, and sometimes you pop your head into it, but that's about it. And you need to pull something down, you know. And as tragic as that actual reality is, we see that more and more actually coming to the fore now, where we have conversations around. We travelled to Belfast to discuss Trevor Burney and their case with the Lochan Island massacre, and you know, realistically, while they said they've had support within the journalist community, that the case is
well, I think they're. What they were basically saying was that their support was far more outside of Ireland than it was within Ireland. I mean, that case stands out, absolutely stands out. You know, you could include it on any of those lists where reporters are being persecuted by the state, and you really could. They did their job to the letter of the law, and yet they're effectively under house arrest.
They're on pre-charge bail.
That's
You know, that restricts their freedom of movement, and in many terms, that is a form of punishment for something that they have never even been charged with.
But the wider message is a dampening of journalistic integrity. It shuts them down.
But when you were on the, say, let's talk about the most recent tribunal. So you're there on the Maurice McCabe one, and you're looking at your phone, and you're seeing the
conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
And a determination to rush to judgment.
Absolutely. And I think when you say, a determination to rush to judgment. But when we saw the report, and we then talked about it, we had Mick Clifford in here, and we talked about the art of the judge, about what the judge actually reported on. And by all accounts, you know, the way we were still able to look at it from this point of view, whereas Maurice McCabe was vindicated. But we also know that certain individuals who were also vindicated had got their, within the context of the report, had their evidence described as disappointing, in certain contexts. So it's a difficult one to square, because people naturally are going to sit back and say, you know, an injustice was done to a man. Was there?
No, sorry. You can look at particular witnesses who appeared, and I'm not going to get into that.
Yeah.
You can look at particular witnesses who appeared and gave evidence and weren't criticised, or were criticised and maybe should have been criticised more. That's fair enough. What you had on a lot of the Twitter feed that I was following and that was replying to the journalists at the thing was people seeing, it wasn't just that here were a couple of cops, or maybe more than a couple of cops, and maybe some people in the department, and maybe a few politicians. It was, here was the entire Irish establishment, including the judge and every lawyer in the room, and the journalists reporting on it, who were all part of a vast conspiracy to do down Maurice McCabe, including Mick Clifford, who wrote a book about him.
So that's
what I mean by a conspiracy. Journalists are addicted to Twitter, and I'm trying to get off it because it amplifies nonsense.
It amplifies nonsense, absolutely. I see. I'd see that as the extreme of it, though. There is room for discourse there, where people can ask questions about individuals, but I don't see any value in someone saying that this isn't, and there was that line that this is the entire state coming down on one man, which was never ever the case.
I don't know, can I take a slightly contrarian view on this?
There's a shocker.
Okay, had it not been for social media, with all its failings, It would have been very hard for that story to get the purchase that it did.
No, that story got the purchase it did because a mainstream journalist called Mick Clifford kept writing about it.
In fairness, Mick did Trojan work on it. Absolutely Trojan
Mick
work on it.
Mick didn't get mileage on that story because three people retweeted a bloody story in the Irish Examiner. Mick got mileage on that story because he wrote about it. And Mick got mileage on that story because, to give them credit, people like Mick Wallace wouldn't shut up about it in the Dáil.
Yeah.
It wasn't a Twitter that did that.
No, no. Mick Wallace, Claire Daly, Mick Clifford. There are a number of people that have to be commended for the work that they put in there. But for it to get into the public conscious, it took more than just writing about it. It took spreading on social media.
No. You go back and you look at what social media was doing. Social media was reacting to what was already published. Social media was reacting to what appeared in the Irish Examiner. Social media was reacting, despite the heat they get, to what appeared on RTE, to what appeared in primetime, to what was reported in the Irish Times. Social media doesn't break stories. Newspapers and TV programs break stories.
But would it be fair to say that it amplifies stories?
Not really.
Why not?
Because the story has already been there. I have 4,000 followers. On my best day, they're not all going to see any tweet that I say.
Yes.
A story in the Irish Examiner, which is the lowest selling daily newspaper, will be bought by and read by 30,000 people. That's where the amplification is. Other newspapers are going to pay attention to, there's a guard down in Mullingarry and he's got some strange allegations, because it appears in the Irish Examiner or the Irish Times, not because someone tweets it on Twitter.
I agree with you. I agree that it's
and
not...
And that is still true amplification. Twitter is noise. And I say this as someone who's on Twitter all the time. It's noise.
I find some of it noise. I also find some of it is quite informative.
But how many times have you seen a Twitter account going, why isn't the mainstream media telling you about this story? Linked to mainstream story.
Quite often that happens.
Yeah.
That's a fair comment where you
say. That is a fair comment.
So too often we do see someone saying, just read about this in X newspaper, why aren't they covering it? And you're like, within three tweets, you're going back on, come on, your source material was the actual newspaper.
Yeah. Or someone comes across a website about something which isn't a newspaper and goes, why aren't you covering this? And sort of fires a tweet off. And you will find a journalist will come back and say, well, here's the story I wrote about it 2 months ago. You weren't paying attention. It's not the same as me not covering it.
Yeah, but I would, and again, this isn't taking a contrarian view. This is actually talking about my own experience of people who, when you actually read stuff in mainstream and from my own selfish perspective, say it's financially related and I see the gaps in it that from, you know, reporting on the central bank and how it doesn't contextualize in an international context, and I criticize on social media. I think that's actually I don't think that's a bad thing that I can turn around and say to someone that actually what you've said here, reported as a good news story, for example, around the tracker mortgage scandal that was going on in an international context, the central bank have proven themselves to be very weak. And it's no harm me being able to say that and use my life experience to actually answer to that. And at least I'm not, and as you say.
But that makes you very rare. That makes you someone that knows what they're talking about. That's incredibly rare. The number of opinions outweighs by a huge proportion the number of people who actually are informed.
But do you think Twitter helps people to get informed, or social media in general helps people to get informed? I mean, there is a decline in newspaper sales. More and more people are getting their news from social media.
Social media elected Donald Trump. That answers that question, I think. Social media is noise.
Oh, did it elect Donald Trump?
Stop. Just stop. Sorry. Donald Trump, social media elected Donald Trump.
Yeah,
okay.
Good point.
Okay, before someone before someone writes something in a newspaper, they fact check it, and quite rigorously. And that's not to say that it's not wrong, and that it, and that they don't get it wrong sometimes. That's not to say that it doesn't come with their own inbuilt biases a lot of the time, because that's unavoidable. But as far as the system, and it's an old system, can ensure everything in it, in the article is bears some relationship to truth. And part of the reason for that is because if it doesn't, you get the arse sued off you.
Yes.
Mm. I'm not going to get sued, probably, not 100%, but I'm probably not going to get sued in this room for anything I say. And the reason is none of us are marks. RTE is a mark. Mm. RTE gets a story law wrong, the next thing you know, they're handing out 50,000 to someone for what was said on a chat show.
Yes.
I say the same thing here. Unlikely that that's going to happen because I don't have 50,000 and no lawyer is going to advise a client to go after me because it's a waste of money.
Yes.
Or maybe I'll get a threatening letter, but and all that's going to happen is I have to do an apology. Mm. But it has to be fairly bad before it even gets to that stage. I'm not a mark. Newspapers aren't a mark. Between contempt of court laws that police what I report when I'm in a courtroom or when I'm at a tribunal, to libel and defamation laws and things like that, newspapers tend to have a reasonably solid relationship to the truth. Most of Twitter is opinion. Some of it is quite informed. If you put a lot of time into moderating and curating your follower lists, you may get an informed account, but often you won't. You certainly won't if you just let Twitter to suggest who to follow. I have experience of this. I was talking to you before we started recording. My main account is Faduda on Twitter, and I've been on that account for 10 years. And I've got a lot of blocks and a lot of mutes, and there's people I choose to follow and not to follow. About 5-6 years ago, I was thinking of setting up an online magazine, and I opened an account for it.
Hmm.
And I basically followed everyone that followed me and pledged money, and it just never took off, but the account stayed there. I didn't delete it.
Hmm.
And because I never changed the default settings, every couple of days I get an email from Twitter going, you may be interested in following these people. And I started after a while just following them. And I set myself just two rules. The one is I'm not following anyone who's outside Ireland. So I was only following Irish people. And second was I'm not following companies. And there's some exceptions to that because I follow some news organizations. But outside of that, I'm not following like Kellogg's Corn Flakes or brand names. But I never actually looked at that account and the content of it until very recently. And when I did, it's a cesspool of noise because it's not filtered.
Mm.
And that's what Twitter is. It's noise. And if you pay a lot of attention and put an awful lot of work into it, you can find the five good voices that are informed. Or you could buy a damn newspaper and do the same thing. Or listen to the radio. And it's like, I mean, podcast universe is exact same as that. There are thousands of podcasts, most of which don't make it past the third episode.
Mm-hmm.
And if I put in a lot of effort, I'll find the three that are real and not the five that are going to disappear after two episodes or the very slightly weird one that has a guy with a faint Russian accent behind it.
like podcasts.
And I don't come here to praise newspapers. I can slag off newspapers and TV stations all night too.
There's one.
I don't buy this thing that Twitter is some sort of savior, or you know, it's lots of voices and mostly they're noise.
No, there's no doubt that a lot of what happens on social media.
See, I am your
noise.
Grumpy grandfather.
But there you go. But there's also an element of some of our newspapers becoming newspapers, whereby a lot of the op-ed,
they've always been that.
Yes, but there's been a cult of of columnists, let's put it.
Again, they've always been that.
I would argue that there's probably more.
You know, I'm amazed at the number of people who in the last 4 or 5 years seem to have discovered that the Wall Street Journal is right-wing.
Yeah, well, that's a fair point, actually.
Well, but I think what I like most about social media, and it's from a political point of view, is a politician can, in the past, when a politician said something on a Monday, you mightn't read a dissemination of that until 2 or 3 days later, before social media. Whereas,
no.
Do you not think so?
Well, what would they say if they wouldn't get reported that long? Outside chance that if a backbencher said something at a meeting in Donegal, you wouldn't hear it for a few days.
No, what I mean is that...
Because the local reporter will probably be the only one there, and he's going to want to keep it for his newspaper, which only comes out once a week.
What I mean is the fact check. The actual fact check that what a TD or a minister said is reported, and we see this still today. It's reported. It's not necessarily fact checked. It's the minister said.
No. I think you misunderstand what a fact check means to a newspaper organization. The minister said X.
Yes.
That's a fact. He either said it or he didn't. Whether it's true or not is a political question, and the way that is covered is you then have the opposition spokesman on the same thing going, actually, the minister is talking through his nether regions. It's not the newspaper's job, traditionally, to fact-check, and that is a problem. But that's not a problem that's new, and that's not a problem that's been really addressed, apart from some websites.
Yeah, now, the Journal has a fact check, and it's a pretty good fact check. It's pretty good, but we see now it's creeping into other areas. But within minutes of... For me, social media is not really social media. It's social memory. When a minister says something, within minutes, you can find, did he say something and not hold an opposite position 12 months ago? Did he contradict himself 3 weeks ago?
Yeah,
that can be found immediately.
But can it?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I often do.
Yeah, but you're following a particular set of people. What if I'm not on Twitter? What if I'm on WhatsApp, like my nephew, who sent me a photo this evening of a bunch of nice deer down in Crow Park? Phoenix Park, sorry.
Yeah, I saw a little of that today.
I mean...
Well, for me, there's a hierarchy of social media, and there is a hierarchy of social media. You don't hear...
Yes, but there's a hierarchy of all media, too. You're not going to get the same stories in the Financial Times that you get in the Daily Sport.
No, you're not. You're not. But the top of the hierarchy is definitely Twitter, in that it's open forum. Everything you say is open for everybody else to see. Facebook is a closed forum. You're talking to the same echo chamber day in, day out. WhatsApp is pretty much the same. Instagram is all about pictures.
But I don't think that just because you can have a chronological stream in Twitter that it gives it some sort of wisdom that's lacking elsewhere. I still think it's the same noise, and it's still down to the same choices that you've made about who to follow, who to listen to, who to block, and who to mute. And ultimately, what it comes down to is an awful lot of people, myself included, feel this is a place that I like to spend time mm-hmm. because I've managed to winnow it down to the people who agree with me.
I would agree in a large part that a lot of people who are on Twitter follow people's whose views generally line with their own. Generally line with their own. Now, I've followed over 3,000 people, everything from crazy Trump people to you know, flat earthers. I'm interested in seeing what's out there from everybody. Now, I won't engage on it all, but I do read it and I do see, sort of feel what the zeitgeist is in different areas. And I think from that point of view, it gives you a much broader picture, a far broader picture than if you just honed it down to the few people who will agree with you.
Yeah, but you could also just buy a newspaper.
I swear, it was like this is the first promoted tweet we've had as a podcast. I actually think that's one thing that I did want to talk about, because we're very lucky. We talked about podcasts and there could be thousands of them. And you're right. The average podcast gets 120 downloads in its first 60 days.
That
and
many?
Yeah. So that's, but like 60 days. Like what are you talking? Like, but anyway, nonetheless, we're kind of lucky to be able to be doing what we're doing and enjoying this and speaking to people. But the model, of the newspaper, and as someone who subscribes to newspapers and pays for newspapers, because I buy, but I get them online. I read them on my tablet. I don't generally buy the physical paper. I'm okay with paying for my news, and I'm like, okay, I curate it myself. You know, that's because I can choose to read the article. I can't. Similar. I'm a bit more, I don't follow as many flat earthers as you, Martin, clearly. But when it comes to the actual media, I'm quite hopeful by some of the people we meet, some of the journalists we meet, some of the actual quality of work that's been done. I do think that, this is to go back to social media, I do think some of them are quite responsive to if you, and you know, as
well, it gives you degree of separation.
As a monolith, it can be a bit defensive of, you know, you can't say News Talk is a misogynist organization.
Oh, you can absolutely say that.
Oh, yeah, but you know, you get my point. You're like, but it's good. We've met great people in News Talk who work for that wider organization. But the point stands that when you talk about a newspaper, and if I want to talk to an individual journalist and offer an opinion, I find that it does mean that they can be quite responsive. And I like to think that they maybe take some things on board, and I think that actually does help. Maybe I'm just giving myself too much credit or being too narcissistic here, but I do think that there's a lot of great people out there doing great work, and I do think that I think the public need to support. If you want decent media, you need to pay something towards it, and if you want to get the news, the media that doesn't just be what we say is editorial control, maybe ask the question every now and then of, you know, if you have an area of expertise like around this, the tracker mortgage scandal, and be able to contextualize it and have that conversation. I found that very helpful from my point of view.
Can I just tell a little anecdote? About 20 years ago, I started investigating and talking about bogus self-employment. And back then, there was no social media. It was impossible, and I mean impossible. And I delivered a bag of envelopes every single week to the Doyle, until the point that they stopped me from doing it, to every single TD in the Doyle, 160-odd envelopes every single week, bringing updates on what had happened. Kind of like social media, kind of like posting tweets. That's exactly what I did. It was impossible to make a breakthrough. It was impossible to make a breakthrough until social media came along. And with the advent of social media, it's been much easier to make a breakthrough. So from my point of view, it has worked very well for me. And just today we have, you know, on Drive Time, we have one of the big subjects that's on it is bogus self-employment and what way the government is dealing with it. So for me, I see it as a complete success. And so social media has absolutely enabled me to do that. Absolutely enabled me to do that. Whereas prior to that, it's a complicated picture. It's difficult to explain it in 250 words. Even if you could explain it in 250 words, you're leaving too much out of the picture. Whereas on social media, you have not only the chance to spread the message, but to talk to journalists and organizations who also are interested in it. And from my point of view, that's great. That's really great. And therefore, social media for me is a success. And I can't see it as any other way but a success.
I suppose, Jared, we're not going to necessarily agree on all of this, because obviously you've referred to Twitter as noise, but you also know that there are good people.
And there myself contributing to the noise. It's fun noise.
Yeah.
But it's not news.
I think we have to agree that it is fun. No matter what way you do it, it is
well,
fun.
That's part of what makes it why I'm trying to cut down, because I don't need to be there. I need to be doing something else.
Well, what do you need to be doing? So, what, like, in terms
earning
of
a shilling.
Well, we all have to do that.
That's the other issue we hear about the, like, you're doing freelance work, you said. So obviously, you know, we see a lot of that when people are trying to actually report on stuff. What is the landscape like in that?
I'm not sure I'm the best person to ask that. For me, at the moment, things are very quiet, but that's just me.
Mm.
Partly I over-specialised, as I said, and there aren't any guards or tribunals at the moment.
Yeah, but that's, they're like buses. I mean, you mightn't see one for a while, well, and then four or five in a row.
Charles is about to be reborn as Ryan. So there's that, which I may or may not cover. I don't know. I think at this stage I'm burnt out.
Mm.
And do you find there's a burnout element with covering guard the tribunals?
At this stage, yes.
Well, nearly 10 years of doing it might be.
Michael McDougall was the senior counsel for Maurice McCabe. He was the Minister for Justice when I started covering the Maurice Tribunal. The Charlton Tribunal was chaired by a judge who was the senior counsel for the tribunal.
Mm.
There are senior counsel, people who were senior counsel down at Charlton who were just starting out as fresh-faced juniors.
Like when you were in the...
When I walked in. I mean, I walked into the first day of the Charlton Tribune. It was like a school reunion. You know, you're going around meeting people going, oh, you've got old too.
Now, I must admit, I did on a couple of occasions go into the Mahon Tribunal. I was in there just to listen, just to see what was happening. It's kind of stuff that interests me. So I was in and I was listening. I also quite often take a little trip down the courts, just have a little listen. For me, it's trying to learn a different language. You know, when you're in the courts, they speak differently. And if you're going to deal with these people, you have to know the language that you're dealing with. So I take little trips in. But as a court reporter for you, it is very niche.
I'm not quite a court reporter. That's a problem. If I was a court reporter, I'd probably be much happier.
We'll have to call Tom
Hughes. I'm a weird, over-specialised branch of the not quite courts, but looks like a court. The tribunal's a very strange animal. First of all, I mean, no court case is going to last. You're not going to measure them in terms of years.
Hmm.
There's very few exceptionals, and they're usually big financial cases or something like that, and they're usually civil, not criminal. But a tribunal lasts, you measure it in terms of years. You know, I was going through, Charlton's zipping along. It's only 18 months. We've had two reports. Yeah. You know, that's breakneck speed.
He did, and that was actually, that was commented upon when he said, oh, you'll have the interim report out. He had the bloody interim report out,
But, see, tribunals are very strange animals. In a court case, a witness gets up, and they present their case, and then they're cross-examined by the defence or defendant. And then you call the next witness. In a tribunal, the witness stands up and says his piece, questioned by the tribunal barrister, who's the equivalent of the plaintiff or the prosecutor. And then he's questioned by the lawyer for the Garda Commissioner, and then he's questioned by the lawyer for the sergeants, and then he's questioned by the lawyers for just the Garda of Garda rank, and then he's questioned by the lawyers for the Department of Health. And then he's questioned by the lawyers of the Department of Justice. And then he's questioned by the lawyer for TUSLA. Mm-hmm. And you're probably going to get GSOC in there a couple of times every now and then. Or some other Garda who incidentally got named in a statement shows up. Or a minister pops in the odd time because he's got... you know, you had lawyers for half a dozen newspapers at the last one because it involved newspaper and media reporting. So they were there in case it was said that they had messed up doing their jobs. So that's the first one. The cross-examination of a single witness goes on forever because they all feel then that they have to be seen to be doing their work.
Mm.
So, you know, if I don't ask any questions because the guy before me asked those questions, my client might think I'm not getting value for money.
Mm.
So I better ask the same questions again. So you get a bit of that repetition. That's part of it. You also have this weird thing that the rules of evidence are different.
Yes.
Hearsay is admissible in tribunals, basically.
Okay, but
because they're not about it's not a criminal case.
Yeah,
it's not a civil case. It's a truth finding exercise.
Which I suppose
The rules of evidence are different as a result. So hearsay is often admissible, specifically because the fact that to give one example. One of the things that everyone remembers is that before a crime call program, Garda Commissioner Martin Callan went up to Philip Boucher-Hayes, and he told Philip Boucher-Hayes that, oh, you want to watch out for that guy and allegations and so forth. And Philip Boucher-Hayes goes in and gives us the evidence that this is what happened, having made a statement. And then he's asked by one of the lawyers for the Garda Commissioner, well, you never told anyone, did you? Well, yes, I did. And he named three other RTE people, producers and researchers and so on, people who were on the staff of the program and said, yeah, I'd mentioned it to them at the time. And the point was he'd mentioned it at the time. Hadn't written anything down, but said, you'll never hear believe what he said to me. So they in turn were called to confirm that that conversation took place. And technically those are... That's kind of okay. That's verifying that what he says he told them. Mm. But you also have people coming in giving evidence of third-party conversations. And the rules of evidence just go all over the place. It's a very strange and peculiar animal.
Do you believe it's a value-for-money animal?
Yes.
You do?
Yeah.
Even though all the tribunals, and I don't mean just the Garda tribunals, but all the tribunals we've seen over the years, there's recommendations sitting on shelves gathering dust.
Well, that's not quite true. There's imperfectly implemented recommendations. We are where we are with Charlton in large part because although there were very good recommendations that came out of Morris about how to reform the Garda Complaints Board, GSOC did not go all the way.
Yes.
Had GSOC gone further in the first place, we might have avoided a lot of what happened. Had the inspectorate been stronger, had there been a way for Morris McCabe to make a complaint that would be properly investigated by an independent ombudsman or authority or inspectorate or whatever you want to call it, we mightn't have had that tribunal.
But they've shied away.
But we would have had an even bigger mess if we hadn't had Morris. Because there were some reforms put in place. Going back to what you said earlier, Moriarty and Mann and so on actually paid for themselves.
Yes, they did.
Believe it or not, because...
The money accrued from at the other end of it has...
The taxman paid attention, basically.
Yes.
I'm not sure you can put a price on the reputation of a family accused of murder in Donegal or on Maurice McCabe, who had incredible things said about him. So in those senses, I'm not sure how you put a price on what it's worth to do that. I think when the state gets it wrong, the state has to be held to account. And however imperfect a tribunal is, I don't think the fact that it's going to cost money is a reason not to do it and not to have a report from a judge that says, here is what happened and here is why it was wrong. And I could probably go through Charlton's report and pick a couple of chapters where I disagree with and said, well, he didn't go far enough there or he could have drawn this conclusion. But I'd rather have that complete report than not have it.
I suppose from my...
And the other thing I would point out is, sorry.
You're okay.
Before Charlton started, there was an article, I think, in the Irish Times. I'm not sure who wrote it, which reviewed one of Charlton's books, because he writes books on, on law and so on. And he basically had this essay at the start about at the heart of every crime is a lie. And without the lie, there's no crime. And the main reason why tribunals take so long and cost so much is because people lie. When a witness goes in and tells the truth, they're usually done by lunchtime. If a witness is still there after a week, it's often, not always, but often, because they're full of crap and the lawyers know it.
But is that not one of the failings?
It's also, of course, sometimes because the lawyer has a client who has given him obnoxious obstructions, but that's another day's work.
Yeah, well, we've seen that very often, whereby we've seen tribunals that we've known, as you said, can be measured in years. But what we've also seen is, you know, teams of people in terms of compellability in these things. And that's whereby, you know, who is going to actually come and in what capacity they come, and when they know they're, you know, do you come as a private citizen? Do you come as a former Garda commissioner? Do you come, you know, we've seen, and that's nothing to do with the actual report, the judge's findings, the recommendations. Some of that is the court of public opinion. And that has been stage managed, I think, around the Morris McCabe, around Charlton, more than any other tribunal I've seen. I think we've seen whereby the stage management of it and the selective reporting of not the journalists per se, but, you know, say politically, there were people who decided this was an opportunity to start hitting you called for Francis Fitzgerald's head. And that was as if, and that phrase was used, called for her head, called for her head. No one called for anyone's head.
But in other news, rain is wet.
Huh?
Yeah.
Politicians played politics. I'm shocked.
Yeah. Well,
I'm shocked to find gambling going on in this establishment.
I'm shocked you're as acerbic here as you are online.
No. I completely.
I'm holding back.
I completely agree with you on that. The nature of politics is
or legal advice.
Yeah.
Is that you can be hoisted by somebody else's petard. That's the nature of politics. You don't actually have to do anything wrong to lose your position as a minister. You can just be in the wrong place, wrong time, with the wrong sentiment coming at you. That's the nature of politics. It's not a job for life. It's not something where you can go to an unemployment appeals tribunal and say, I was unfairly dismissed. That's not what politics is about. You serve at the pleasure of the electorate. And if the electorate don't like you anymore, goodbye. That's the way it works. That's the job you sign up for.
I'd kind of prefer if we could do that every couple of years sometimes. But anyway, 5 years can be a long old time sometimes.
Would you see a better model than tribunals? Do you think there is a better model than tribunals?
If you've got one, give it to me. Back when Morris was going on, you also had Mahan and Moriarty, and you'd just had the Bar Tribunal as well. And there was a lot of political noise about how this is terribly expensive, and Michael McDougall brought in the Commissions of Investigation Act. And the Commissions of Investigation Act basically decided that, well, we'll have it behind closed doors, and that will reduce the legal costs because it will reduce the need for all these cross-examinations because journalists won't be repeating nice sound bites every day that have to be challenged by lawyers. And there was an entire module looking at the problems that that led to. And the fact, the instructions that were given to counsel behind closed doors, mm-hmm. and whether ministers knew about those instructions, and whether ministers, knowing or not knowing about those instructions, should have interfered in what the commissioner was doing, and so on, which led to calls for heads. And I could probably spend a fair amount of time going into all that, but commissions of investigation were proposed as a better way to do tribunals. And I think in every conceivable way, they were worse. I think fundamentally, justice must be administered in public.
Yes.
And that can be expensive.
Yeah, couldn't agree more with you. Could not agree more with you. Anything that's done in private is not, cannot claim to be justice. Justice must be seen to be done. Not just done, but must be seen to be done. I have a bee in my bonnet about closed shop tribunals, where awful things happen, and they do happen in closed shop tribunals. That said, would it not have been easier to have something like the investigative body that they have up north? Which seems to do very good work and seemed to be able to get through.
I'm not familiar
much
with what the investigative body is. The ombudsman,
yeah.
It's a different job. If we had, I mean, I used to joke back in the day when they were bringing in the Ombudsman Commission that what they should do was tear up the Garda Síochána bill and just go up to Belfast with a checkbook and ask Nuala Alone how much.
Didn't joke that much.
I mean, it seems quite a sensible thing to do.
I'm not saying we should hire Nuala Alone. What I am saying is, it's one of the few times when we didn't cut and paste legislation from the British Parliament.
Very true.
And it's one of the times when we really ought to have thought about that. The number of times I have spoken to people, because I get, if you Google Garda complaints and stuff, you sometimes get my name because I've covered these tribunals, so I get people who call me who've had issues. And the number of times I talk to people and I get to the point in the story was, and did you go to the Garda Ombudsman? And they go, yes, and the superintendent showed up to interview me.
Mm.
And no disrespect to the Garda superintendents of Ireland, but if you've made a complaint about a cop and another cop shows up, that doesn't instill faith in the process. And we need a better Garda Ombudsman. The Garda Ombudsman is fine as far as it goes. It does not go anywhere near far enough. It needs to be independent. It needs greater funding. It needs staff who are not and never have been Gardaí.
Yes.
Because not only do you have a superintendent or a chief superintendent show up to take someone's complaint when they've contacted the Garda Ombudsman, you have people who are not members of Garda Síochána who work for the Ombudsman, but are in fact former Gardaí.
Mm.
And again, no reflection on them. The reason they're hired is because the Garda Ombudsman needs investigators,
yes,
and former cops are investigators.
Yeah.
But there are other police forces, and we need to be hiring people who are not Gardaí and have a properly, visibly independent Ombudsman. That would not necessarily have fixed all of the issues that were going on that were led to Charlton. I mean, the Ombudsman has no power to go into Tuzla, for example.
Mm.
And I'm not even going to start on that mess.
Yeah, please don't.
But the Ombudsman in the Republic is far short of what's needed.
Yes.
And that's separately of whether or not we need a different mechanism to tribunals.
Do you think that we're inevitably just going to keep having tribunals going forward, particularly into Garda practice? Or do you think we will actually reach a point where we're, in general, we all have faith in what the Gardaí do and how they do it?
I don't know. Tribunals aren't about what goes on in the guards. Tribunals are actually about what goes on in the Dáil. The reason we had, they could have actually fixed everything that was going on in Charlton if there hadn't been a panic in the Dáil because everyone thought that the government was going to fall. And you got this weird, ominous thing of some incredibly vague and some incredibly specific terms of reference that were just thrown together in a panic. But that happened because of political pressures, not because of what was happening in Garda Síochána. Politicians don't want tribunals generally because they tend to lead to questions being asked. But they will set up scoping exercises and hire a senior counsel to review the paperwork and then maybe a commission of investigation. And if they cannot avoid it at all, they will have a tribunal. But they will have it because it's politically embarrassing, not because it's a problem within the guards.
Yes.
And there are deep cultural problems in the guards. Again, going back 10 years or more, I remember saying they needed an external Garda commissioner. We've now seen that. I think we need 3 or 4 of those.
Mm, before we see...
And go even further afield. Hire a Canadian, maybe.
Hmm.
I remember there was one Canadian who I would have pointed them out about 15 years ago, but he's probably near retirement age at this stage. But go to other jurisdictions, hire senior police officers from those jurisdictions, hire a lot more civilians within the Garda Síochána, because we have a very low civilian employment rate in there. Open it up further to freedom of information, because Ireland is very closed on that.
It is, yeah. And it's only recently that the Garda Síochána have been subject to freedom of information.
Well, just about subject to information, freedom of information in very limited circumstances, as I'm sure Ken Fox covered with you.
Yes. Poor Ken gets an awful time from us.
Well, it is important. It's no different to any other body within the state. It is important that we are able to see how it operates, to see the mechanics of how it operates. And when you don't have that access, it feels like you have a closed shop and you're not being allowed to look in, which is exactly the Garda Síochána is.
Can I come in and just say, actually, 40 minutes in, and I'm actually much more informed about the necessity of tribunals, the work of tribunals, the imperfections of tribunals, and the pressures that cause tribunals. And I am, Gerard. I mean that honestly, because I don't want to be the guy who's standing there going, but what about Noreen's phones? Screaming, you know. We do have to understand that this is the vehicle. Okay. Is it perfect? You're not saying it's perfect. We're not saying it is, but it is the vehicle we're using currently. And it is better than something, as you've said, Martin, that's happening. At least it's happening in public as behind closed doors.
Well, I do. I agree. Anything that happens in public is better than happening in private where justice is concerned. Absolutely. Mm. The public must be able to see that justice is being done. Otherwise, it's just not being done.
I want to end on a hopeful note.
Good luck.
Yeah, what I mean by that is we've talked about the challenges. We've talked about the challenges in the social media era as well of breaking through the noise and in declining newspaper sales. This is the reality of the situation. It is, as going back to Philip O'Connor's phrase, it's a great time to be a journalist. It's sometimes it's just a bad time for the business model. Because the reporting is you can, as Martin said, there's a lot less degrees of separation between you and some stories or so you and some context. You can make these connections a lot better because of this, but it also does mean that there's a lot more disinformation and there's a lot more. But we've spoken to people recently about being more optimistic, more utopian was the word that was thrown at us the other day, Martin. I'd like to see that, you know, the work that people are doing, the reporting that's been doing, given a platform outside of where people are challenging the RTEs and the Communicores and this. I don't know where the model is. I don't know how it's going to come into fruition, but I like to think that we're going to get there in the next couple of years. I know in the UK, what's the shared one? I'll put a note on the podcast, but there's another one where people can contribute their work and it's a general platform. And that's starting to build, and people are actually again chipping in a couple of pounds per month or whatever it is, and they're trying to get these things off the ground. And I do think that there is something to it, because I genuinely think people want quality news, and they will be able to curate it themselves. That is that always a good thing? Maybe not, but there's always room for when it's going to be reported, and when their truth is reported, still it's just the truth.
I think we have. I don't know if the paywall model will last, and I don't know. There's a lot of stuff that goes behind a paywall that really should be out in the public domain. It's important stuff. The Sunday Business Post covers some of the best stuff in this country. It does some of the best stories in this country.
I pay for it.
Yeah, but it's behind a paywall. So, you know, not everybody's getting to see the work that they're doing. Is that a great idea? Not sure. I think there has to be some element of you've got to give a little to get a little. These days, particularly, you have to in anything you're trying to do. I don't know if the model of newspapers, people buying newspapers, is going to last a whole lot longer. It's got to get to the point where it's just not, it just doesn't wash its own face, and it's not going to work.
I don't know. I want to talk so much for being optimistic, Jared. What do you reckon?
You're asking me about the future of newspapers?
Yeah.
Future of newspapers or journalism? Newspapers are doomed.
That's hopeful. Well, that's hopeful.
It's doomed to one in here anyway.
Paper is doomed. The daily newspaper will go first. Mm. And local newspapers will diminish in number and quantity. You can already see an awful lot of newspapers are a lot thinner than they were 10 years ago. Yeah. Every time the ABC circulation figures come out, physical copies are down. The problem is that, I remember about 18 months ago, there was an article where I think it was The Independent, was beating his chest about the fact that there had been a 10% increase in digital revenues.
Yeah.
But the same circulation figures, the same annual return showed that there had actually been a decline in print revenues. And the decline in print revenues was greater, not greater than the increase in digital revenues, greater than their entire digital revenues.
Wow.
And that is a shocking statistic.
And that's where it goes. The Irish Times seems to be at the edge of getting some sort of digital viability. I'm not sure. Mm. The Sunday Business Post, I'm quite frankly mystified it's still going.
Because it's behind the paywall.
No, because they sell so few physical copies. They've got very few digital subscriptions as well.
And it's actually one of the best. It's, you know, for the long read.
People, I mean, the point is though, I mean, physical copies are going to continue to decline to the point where you will find the Irish Times and the Independent will stop doing a daily newspaper. They'll do three times a week. They'll still do the Saturday paper.
Yeah.
Because the Saturday paper twice as many as a Saturday paper is basically a Sunday. Mm. It sells twice as many. They sell twice as many papers on Saturday as any other day of the week. But, you know, Monday might go away or Wednesday or Tuesday. And then, there's newspapers already in America have gone from daily to three times a week, two times a week.
I remember being able to get US newspapers here on a daily basis.
But that kind of is the death knell for it, though, isn't it?
They will move online. They will try podcasts, some of which will be better than others. I'm not sure how good the market is for podcasts in Ireland.
I'll tell you, there's no money in them. Even
with the promotion of a brand behind them, one of the things I keep noting is that the Journal isn't really doing podcasts.
The Journal tend to be
quite innovative in terms of new ways to sell online. Mm. So the fact that they have been so slow to go into it suggests to me that there's not a very deep pool there. Mm.
Well, I think I looked at the figures recently. About 1% of the Irish population listen regularly to podcasts, but that's way, way more than they do in the UK. We have a taste for
podcasts. It's a lot more than 1%. It's...
On a regular basis. But that's a lot more than in the UK. I think our figures, podcast listening per capita in Ireland, is twice what it is in the UK.
Part of that is over how you define podcasts in a survey, because people in the UK don't count listening to the BBC on delayed.
Yes, yes.
And the BBC has a huge amount of content that they are actually quite focused on pushing out that way. Whereas RTE, Today FM, News Talk, whoever, their podcast content is not really something they put a lot of time and effort into.
They just regurgitate the show.
One of the things the BBC has that helps a lot is, like, BBC Four has a lot of half-hour shows. Mm. You know, so they're like a naturally made length for a podcast.
Yeah.
And they tend to be topic-focused. Mm. Whereas Sean O'Rourke is like 2 hours long and it's all over the place. Mm. So you end up chopping it up into half a dozen little segments. It's quite difficult to brand that because you can go from here's an opera singer talking to her child to some TD giving out about potholes.
And you'll find out that you've missed something and then they'll tell you they won't have podcasts that actual interview. Mm. It'll be gone.
Well, again, it's down to the level of resources too. Yeah. They have 10 times our population and therefore the BBC has a lot more revenue. to play with.
I just think that when you talk about the innovation in that, the innovation is like, I mean, we can talk about numbers. Our numbers are we're flattered by our numbers, but we can't put them in context of something like what a Rubber Bandits podcast does, you know. But nonetheless, you talk about the market that you're talking into. There is good crossover potential there for media, where you've seen with the Irish Times politics podcast recently, they've added a sponsor. You know, there's a little ad in the middle of the podcast, and Eamon Dunphy's there with bringing a sponsor on his as well. You know, and
I mean, part of the problem is that no one has really figured out how to measure audience and put on podcasts. I mean, everyone sort of, you know, you're trusting that Apple is measuring something and that it means something.
Yeah, yeah.
But no one is quite sure. Android is a black box. Mm-hmm. Google is sort of, everyone keeps saying, oh, Google has just invented Google Podcasts. Google's about to get it. No, they haven't done it yet. It's like waiting for Google to invent Google Plus. You've just got Google Buzz and Google Plus and Circles. And they keep almost doing something, but never quite. And that means that half the market is unmeasurable.
I can tell you for the...
Meanwhile, print revenues are falling. The revenues that you're getting from online subs are not replacing them. The ad rates are nowhere near what you were getting for display. So I think you're going to get consolidation, which is a nice business speak word for unemployed journalists. There's a limit to the size of the market for audio, because podcasts are going to get more professional. There are going to be more of them. And they're going to be, podcast is paradoxical, because the two things that radio has, that newspapers have to do to move into podcasting is not sound like radio, but at the same time sound more like radio than most podcasts do. Because I've had a great time sitting here for the last hour, but an hour is a long time to listen to a show.
It is.
And most radio, most podcasts that I'm hearing, which are not from radio stations, which are from newspapers or from online websites, are going to the hour-long format. And yeah, but you know, you need to be producing 15-minute products. You need to be doing the equivalent of NPR and the New York Times, which is producing the daily, which is like a 10 or a 15-minute daily news brief. 12
minutes, off you go, yeah.
You know, those products are not being produced in Ireland. I'm not, you know, I had someone talking to me about doing a 1-minute daily, which was also going to be on video, and I'm going, don't pivot to video. So that may or may not happen yet, but, you know, I'm not seeing those innovations yet. I don't know how big the market is in Ireland.
I think, in fairness, nobody knows how big it is, or potentially, you know, how big it could be.
You look at American markets and you suddenly realize that most of those aren't big enough to support media outlets. Ireland's the size of a medium-sized American city.
That's the reality. So, well,
thanks very much for coming in and having a chat with us. It's all food for thought. It's definitely all food for thought, particularly on the media and the social media end. And I hope that you enjoy your break from Twitter. And I'll say it's only a break.
Changing.
I think the draw is very, again, as we said, it's fun. So the draw is there. It's very difficult to give it up cold turkey.
Jared, I really enjoyed that now, but I'm also a bit more pessimistic about the viability of podcasts now. But there you go. Thanks for your time. Appreciate you coming in. Listen, folks, here we go again. Now we thanks for listening. Maybe throw us a review and let people know that we're out there, because as Jared said, it's a very little market. We need you to spread the word.
Thanks very much.
Bye bye.